Good morning. This is the Global Research News Hour, which is coming to you from Montreal. It's an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. My name is Michel Chostadovsky. Today we have a very special guest, Professor Peter Dale Scott, who is a distinguished author and analyst of both the national as well as international context, focusing on geopolitical issues, the whole issue of national security in the United States, as well as the ongoing financial crisis. Peter Dale Scott has just published an article which is entitled Martial Law, the Financial Bailout, and War. Welcome to the program, Peter.
It's good to be with you again, Michel.
We're delighted to have you on the show. This is a very incisive review of what's happening in America, which is not always understood. Could you give us perhaps an outline? You focused on the bailout measures of late 2008, and you suggest that some very serious consequences in the area of possibly martial law and also the militarization of law enforcement.
Let me put it this way, that I think most people look at the bailout as a response to economic developments of the last few years, whereas I look at it and at a parallel development in America, which is increased planning for military operations inside the continental United States. I think the core of my article is to look at both of these developments in the perspective of time and see them as contributing to each other. I talk about how at times of changes of party in the White House, we're now going from a Republican president to a Democratic one, and that when this has happened in the past, as particularly, say, 1960, when Kennedy came in after Nixon, or again when Carter came in after Nixon and Ford, that the bureaucracy, or particularly what I call the deep state, the non-accountable part of the bureaucracy, makes plans which sort of bind, limit the freedom of operation of the new Democratic president. And it's very obvious that the bailout has severely limited the freedom of action of Obama, because he was campaigning on things like universal health care and all kinds of progressive reforms, but he's had to announce that he sounded just like a Republican, in fact, when he said that this crisis, we've spent spending so much money on the bailout and on the war, that we're going to have to exercise financial austerity on other programs. Now, my point is with the bailout that this is not the first time that, in fact, it's almost a predictable thing that a Democratic president will find his hands bound in this way. What most people don't know about is that I wrote a book about it, deeply, The Road to 9/11, is that there have been plans being made secretly by a very restricted and very unaccountable group of people, some of them not even in government, have been planning since the early 1980s to make arrangements for, well, the name of the planning has been Continuity of Government, COG.
We'll have to go for a commercial break. We'll be back after the break with a longer time period. This is Michel Chostadovsky speaking with Peter Dale Scott. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chostadovsky. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest today, distinguished author, former Canadian diplomat and professor at the University of California at Berkeley, is Peter Dale Scott, who is discussing with us issues pertaining to the bailout and its social consequences. Peter, when the bailout legislation was presented in the U.S. Congress, you mentioned in your article that members of Congress were warned that failure to act and to implement the bailout would threaten civil unrest and the imposition of martial law. But in fact, if we analyze these bailout programs, they don't really resolve. They don't constitute a safety net for the American people and what's happening to them as a result of the financial crisis. So is the imposition of martial law still something which could happen in America?
Well, I keep talking about not so much just martial law, but preparations for martial law. And America has had, since the Civil War, or the Reconstruction era after it, what are called Posse Comitatus Acts, which forbid the use of the U.S. Army for law enforcement purposes, except in extreme emergency situations. And there have been 20 years of quiet planning to change that, so that, for example, in 2002, for the first time, they created a military command for the continental United States, treating North America, NORTHCOM, just like South America, SOUTHCOM. And then more recently, in October, I think it was, they have transferred a combat brigade, which is trained in, you know, shooting at people and so on. This is absolutely unprecedented, has been moved from Iraq to the United States to deal with, as they say, loss of order. Again, this is not something which has just been thought up in the last few months. This is the fruit of planning which goes back to the Reagan era, and in which two people have been involved in the planning from the outset, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, even in the 1990s when neither of them had any connection to the U.S. government. They still had been given by Reagan this power to plan for what I would say the potential imposition of martial law in this country.
Absolutely, but now what has changed in the post bailout period is the likely consequences of this financial crisis on employment, wages, home ownership, and so on across America, and the possibility that this is going to generate widespread social repercussions. Is that the scenario which is unfolding, that we're in for a very serious economic depression which will affect people's lives in a very dramatic way and could in fact trigger a situation of protest across America?
Well, as I say in my article, it's very difficult to predict the future. We've already seen that the initial bailout, what in my article I call the Paulson bailout of last fall, is the beginning, not the end, of what really is raiding the public treasury for the benefit of those whose wealth is above average. We're going to see more of that, I think. This is one of the ways in which Obama's hand has been restricted. There is a secular trend here, which I think, again, has to be brought up, and that is that up until the mid-70s, or roughly speaking, until Reagan came into office, the public treasury was used, when there were conscious policies of directing it to part of the income of the public, it was to benefit the poor, to fight a war on poverty, to try to diminish the gap between the wealth of the richest and the wealth of the poorest. And since about 1980, there's been a very visible move in the opposite direction, that the wealth are getting wealthier, and the not just the poor, but the middle class are getting poorer. And this, of course, has huge political consequences. When you get that kind of disparity, it's very difficult to have democracy. That's why South America looks the way it is. You have elite classes, and you have peasants, and a great deal of violence when you have that kind of situation. I'm not saying that somebody has planned to make us a more disparate society. I'm saying that things proceed by a kind of laws of probability, and when you have the rich dominating politics to the extent that they do now in the United States, that you're going to see, you're much more likely to see legislation which protects the interests of the rich, and that's exactly what the bailout was. I mean, the bailout was rewritten in at the final stages to allow the CEOs of the people who had presided over this financial insanity to continue to pay themselves bonuses. So we're using the public treasury to subsidize, in effect, really the super rich. That's not that they plan to do it that way, but that's what you get when you have this kind of disparity. The probability is that the interests of the rich will be taken care of first, and that, of course, will be at the expense of the poor. And so, yes, I am very concerned. The heart of my article, though, is about the martial law planning, which is, I think, much less publicized, and is, I think, and as I say, goes together with the bailout planning.
But I think
one other thing we haven't brought up yet, and that is that although the timing of the crisis was such that it exploded in the second half of 2008, it was no surprise to anybody. People saw it coming. And among the people who saw it coming was Governor Eliot Spitzer of New York. And the states were taking their own measures to block predatory lending, which, of course, is the heart of this crisis. A lot of junk derivatives were based on phony mortgages, which were not going to go nowhere. And beginning of the decade, state attorney generals, not just Spitzer's, were planning to stop that. And then the Bush administration intervened with a very obscure regulation, which, interestingly, goes back to the Civil War, and forbade them to take these measures. In other words, the federal government, the Bush administration, artificially prolonged this bubble, which led to the tremendous downturn which we're seeing now.
Now, just another important question, because we will be having a new administration in the White House very soon.
The question is, how new can it be?
Is there continuity with the Bush administration? Are the people involved in the Treasury, because it's the CEO is Timothy Geithner? The CEO of Federal Reserve Bank of New York is now becoming the Secretary of the Treasury under the new administration.
Right.
What can we expect?
And Lawrence Summers, who was Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, where, again, these policies evolved, the deregulation, allowing of the banks to take these wild ventures into crazy money. Lawrence Summers is going to be head of the Council of Economic Advisers.
Absolutely.
That's not what worries me so much. I mean, I would like to have seen a Stiglitz or a Paul Krugman or a James Galbraith or somebody to balance these people. I understand that there has to be a certain amount of continuity. What worries me much more is the response of the new incoming administration to the continuity of government planning, And we've had Rahm Emanuel, who will be the new chief of staff, say just in the last couple of days that when it comes to protecting the American people against terrorism, there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Well, a great many terrible things happened in the last 8 years in the name of combating terrorism. We got torture. We know he's going to stop torture. But we got warrantless surveillance, which is now being signed into law by a Democratic Congress. To hear that there is no difference between the Democrats and Republicans on the matter of terrorism, I think is very, very bad news for people who've been studying the Republican response to terrorism and seeing how much of this continuity of government planning has been instituted under that guise.
Absolutely. And I presume we'll have to be going to a short commercial break soon, but again, the foreign policy context is also relevant because in effect, we have continuity as well with regard
to war. We haven't talked about war yet, but we will have to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, we are talking to Peter Dale Scott. This is Michel Shostakovsky. We're going to a short commercial break. Stay with us. We'll be back with a discussion on these very important issues which are affecting America.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Shostakovsky. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Peter Dale Scott's article is one of our lead cover stories. I should also mention perhaps Peter Dale Scott will give us also his website. It's peterdalescott.net.
And you can order.
I beg your pardon?
You said it correctly. www.peterdalescott.net.
And they can order the book right from your website or recent book?
They can order my recent books from the website, yes.
So Peter Dale Scott's most recent book is The War Conspiracy, JFK 9/11, and Deep Politics of War. And his website, peterdalescott.net. We were discussing issues of foreign policy.
If I could just interrupt, Michel. The discussion of continuity of government is more in the book before that, came out in 2007, The Road to 9/11. That's where I really talk about
absolutely
continuity of government.
And that can also be, on your website.
Correct. Yes.
Very good. Now, let's get back to the issue of U.S. foreign policy. How does it relate to the picture that you've described in your article? Your article is focusing both on internal politics as well as U.S. As the U.S. military adventure in the Middle East.
Right, and the. I say that the last election that we had, which was a symptom of the growing influence of wealth in limiting the political debate in America, that it was a contest between a candidate who wanted to fight two wars, McCain, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and a candidate only wanted to fight one war, which was in Afghanistan. And actually, although Obama became popular by saying that he wanted to disengage in Iraq, and by the way, I don't think his disengagement is going to be anything like as total as some of us would like to see, but his reason for disengaging in Iraq, and I'm quoting from his website now, is that the scale of our deployments in Iraq continues to set back our ability to finish the fight in Afghanistan. Well, anybody who knows anything about Afghanistan knows that no great power ever, starting from Alexander the Great and including the British and most recently the Russians, no one has ever been able to fight local forces in Afghanistan and finish. And there's been very serious warnings to this effect from all kinds of experts. In fact, there isn't, I think, a serious expert who would claim anything different. So the idea that we are planning to finish the fight means we're going to escalate. The only way you can try to finish is to introduce vastly more troops into Afghanistan and also escalate your strategy. And the strategy has been most recently cross-border operations into Pakistan, which, although we've only seen a very relatively few of them so far, they have been enough to wildly destabilize what is, in any case, a very weak civilian government, so that a prolonged war in Afghanistan, you can guarantee, will become a prolonged war in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and one would hope it would just be in the Northwest Frontier Territory, but the destabilization is so great that I'm afraid it will affect the whole of Pakistan, a country which, on the one hand, has very, very, very insecure democracy and is often called a failing state, and on the other hand, has nuclear weapons. So that the idea that you could somehow put the extremists, the fundamentalists in power in Pakistan, would be a major catastrophe for the world.
But in fact, if we look at the Middle East broadly, focusing on recent events in Palestine, what seems to be unfolding is a process of escalation where these three, I mean, we could say that now we have three war theaters. We have Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. And if things develop as they're developing, we may, in fact, be dealing with an extended war theater, which goes from the Eastern Mediterranean right through to, you know, to Pakistan and the Chinese border.
Right. These crises are becoming more and more interconnected. There's no question. That could be a matter for hope, because, you know, I'm a poet as well as a political analyst, and as a poet, I have utopian dreams, and my utopian dream is that the major powers of the world would try to settle three major areas of tension, which I think are soluble, but because just, you know, local resistance have not been solved. One is Palestine, a second is Kashmir, and a third is Chechnya. And the best solution, I think, would be one which tried to resolve all three. People who are less utopian than I am, I've talked very seriously in the Journal of Foreign Affairs. This is Barnett Rubin and Ahmed Rashid, two very expert observers.
We have to go to commercial break again. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal, Canada. It's an initiative of Global Research, the Center for Research on Globalization. My name is Michel Chosadovsky. Our distinguished guest on the program today is Professor Peter Dale Scott, who is discussing with us issues, very broad issues of U.S. politics and foreign policy. Welcome back, Peter. We were focusing on the Middle East when we, just before the commercial break.
I was about to say that first of all, I'd like, because I've been saying some depressing things, there are reasons to hope for better policies from Obama, but in the Middle East, he's talked about but having a more multilateral approach rather than just pushing the recent U.S. military doctrine has been called full spectrum dominance, that the idea is that Americans should be overwhelmingly powerful in a way which dominates not only enemies but even allies. And Obama has tried to, well, he has sounded different. He's said he would pursue a foreign policy dedicated to diplomacy and multilateralism. He even said that he would talk to Iran without preconditions. That's a very fresh note, which I think is an absolutely necessary precondition for any kind of improvement of the situation in Asia. The problem is that there has been this momentum building up over decades for, well, now we get into questions of, you know, the U.S. dependence on oil and the fact that oil, unfortunately, was found in Central Asia and Iraq, and the project there was to build a pipeline. U.S. oil companies now have began extracting oil and gas from the regions, the so-called stands in Central Asia that used to be part of the Soviet Union, and the only way they can get them out until recently was through the Soviet Union. So they have interest now in a pipeline that goes through Georgia to Turkey, and they would like to build a pipeline through Afghanistan. And, of course, we have seen warfare following those desires in both those countries. Obama is going to have to choose at a certain point whether his priorities are really diplomatic or they are military. And if they're diplomatic, there are proposals, and this was in Foreign Affairs, which is the top sort of establishment foreign policy journal, that this is, as I was saying, from Barnett Rubin and Ahmed Rashid, two very competent observers, that you bring in all of the neighbors around Afghanistan, and they all have a stake in seeing peace, and this would involve China and Russia as well as India and Pakistan and Iran. That's the rational way to go. But the depressing note in my article is that as states become progressive and democratic, they become dominant, and when they become dominant, they expand over beyond their own frontiers, and instead of becoming more rational, they become less rational. And so in Britain, which was the preeminently progressive society of the 19th century and the most democratic, you got the Boer War, which was suited the private needs of Cecil Rhodes. And Kevin Phillips, in his book, Wealth and Democracy, makes this generalization about all the great empires, that they destroy themselves by developing a taste for warfare which cannot be checked by the internal institutions of the country. And the fear is that America is slipping into a repetition of that kind of dependence on military means to project its presence beyond its borders. I hope that's not true.
But I think a key issue in this transition to a new administration, we know that the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, is staying on.
Yes.
And in other words, that as far as the Pentagon is concerned, there's no substantial shift in the power structures, and during the Bush administration there were...
Michelle, could I comment on that? It is,
yes,
obviously very striking that he's asked the Secretary of Defense to stay on, who is, of course, a Republican. Gates is a very complex person, and I could say a lot of terrible things about him or some quite good things about him. The terrible thing is that he was with Zbigniew Brzezinski when the United States plotted its way into Afghanistan in the first place back in the late 1970s. But on the other hand, offsetting that is the fact that both he and Brzezinski have been perhaps leading voices in saying that we have to we think our policies towards Iran. And one of the things that has emerged that's hopeful, I think, is that it would be no surprise to most people listening to this broadcast that there was a lot of pressure when Bush was president to bomb Iran, attempt to take out the nuclear capacities. And we now know that Israel requested permission from the United States to overfly Iraq in order to do exactly that. And thank heavens, Donald Rumsfeld had left, was no longer Secretary of Defense, and the Bush administration in its declining months refused to give that permission. That, I think, is the good Robert Gates.
Yeah, but I agree with you, but I'm very skeptical on whether that kind of warning to Israel was real, because in effect, what's happening now is that the United States is collaborating. First of all, they've announced us sending masses of new weapons to Israel, 3,000 tons, and they're building a new air defense system directed against Iran. So now it seems to me totally unreal that the U.S. military would start saying to the Israelis, you can't do this, you can't do that, because decisions are taken. They take those decisions together. I don't buy those news reports that have come out on this restraint to Israel.
Can I comment in a more general way about this? My article is hard to summarize because it tries to take in so much, but one of the things that it failed to address, which is very relevant, is, of course, the U.S. Position towards Israel. And yeah. There isn't very much wiggle in there. You get, you had under Bush, you had PNAC people like Richard Perle affecting policy, people dedicated to opposing any kind of peace process. And on the Democratic side, you have Ross, who is in favor of the peace process. But there isn't, in fact, very much difference between the two, because yeah. Neither the Democrat nor the Republicans are going to put the kind of pressure on Israel which will have to be put if you're going to see a serious peace process. So this is, of course, a very depressing era. It's also not new, Michel. We've been living with this for 40 years. So
absolutely. I think when you point to the role of Brzezinski as a moderating role, I think that is certainly, it's not that Brzezinski has a different long-term objective, but he does believe in diplomacy. And that, in that sense, I think there's certain positive element which might emerge, not in the fact that the United States is going to retreat from some of their objectives in the Middle East, but they may do it differently.
I think that, the best and the worst of Brzezinski is that he doesn't care about the Middle East as much as he cares about Russia. He is a Pole. I knew him at McGill, by the way. You know, we were both
with
McGill together, and he was fanatic on the question of Russia and communism even when he was an undergraduate. But he seems to have learned a little bit of sense, and yes, I think that he's smart enough to see that America's future is much more secure in a multilateral world where America's dominance is not severely challenged than in the Bush approach was to really almost invite a clash of civilizations and become a factory for breeding terrorists. I mean, they did a very good job on containing the terrorists who were already active, like Osama bin Laden. The problem was that they were generating whole new mobs of terrorists in little terrorist factories like Iraq became in the first half of this decade, so that we have a more serious problem now, and I repeat, it's an article of faith. No one can prove these things, that the best solution will be a diplomatic one, and we do have a better chance of that with Obama. Let me repeat that. The trouble is that we have these long-term plans, and by the way, the bailout, when you say, why would, if Spitzer is right, and I'm sure he is right, why would the federal government have exaggerated the bubble and blocked all 50 states from dealing with it? There was unanimous opposition from all 50 states. Why such dedicated pursuit of insanity? Well, what I suggest in my article is that because these derivatives and other instruments based on the predatory lending were marketed all over the world, it had the effect of restoring the disastrous decline of the U.S. dollar, and in the long run, when it brought on the recession, of bringing back oil prices to a level which would be better for not only better domestically for the United States, $40 a barrel is a lot better than $150, but also weakened Russia and weakened Iran and, above all, weakened Saudi Arabia, whose millionaires and billionaires were subsidizing the extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I think there have been sinister people working there, and all of it on a level where democracy, a public rational debate, is not allowed to contribute anything. And one of the features we must see in the new bailout, because it looks like there's going to be a new one, first of all, I would like to see a bailout that affects the working class, benefits the working class as well as the upper class. But I would also like to see a bailout with transparency where you can get some kind of accountability as to how the money is spent, and not have expense paying dividends.
Yeah, but there's another, I think, broad question, and you raised it right at the beginning of our program, is the fact that this bailout comes from the Treasury, or at least a good part of it comes from the Treasury, which means that it's financed by tax dollars, or at least it competes with other categories of expenditure, and it is likely to lead to the most serious public debt crisis in American history, because it's still...
We're already at record levels on the public.
We're already at record levels, but what will it imply? Because on the one hand, you can finance it by slashing every single other category of public expenditure, perhaps with the exception of defense, and then on the other hand, you can start issuing treasury bills and government bonds at what? At very, very low interest rates, which
yes.
People won't necessarily...
Zero is, in fact, a very low interest rate. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's worse, Michel, I have to interrupt again. It's worse than what you just said, because yes. Behind the Treasury bailout has been the Federal Reserve bailout, which began last spring, has been totally unheralded, is totally unaccountable for things. Congress doesn't know what they're doing. Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply. And you have Bloomberg, a billionaire, mayor of New York, and Bloomberg is suing the Federal Reserve to get them to provide some kind of accountability for what they've been doing with their bailout, which is even bigger than the $700 billion Treasury bailout. So
that's clear. The $700 billion bailout under the Troubled Assets Relief Program is only the tip of the iceberg. We're talking about, I think there was a breakdown. It goes up to something like $8.5 trillion, the different components of bailouts, both through the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and various other agencies. And it's an incredible injection of cash, which is then taken...
Without debate, without any kind of theory. The way it was rushed through Congress was with the threat that there might be martial law, and we have two senators who, Senator Imhoff and Representative Sherman, have confirmed that both houses were given these threats.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, both parties, money is calling the dictating the politics of both parties, so that it's a very worrisome time for democracy in America.
Yes, indeed.
All I can say is I want to balance that with the statement that whatever we get in the cabinet, we're going to get a far better cabinet than we had under the Bush administration. And we just have to, as the point of my article is that the parameters here limiting choices, whether the party is Democratic or Republican, I think the root problem is disparity of wealth and income in America. And every new policy, particularly the ones on the financial side, should be measured by the criterion, is this going to increase or diminish the disparity of wealth and income in America? That, to me, is the root problem that we're facing here and leads to why we have this impetus towards war and the refusal to conduct serious diplomacy and so on. That is the root problem.
Yes, well, it very much depends on the team of people who are working with Obama. We're going to go for a short commercial break, and we'll be back with our guest, Peter Dale Scott, to conclude this hour's program. So stay with us. This is Michel Chalcedovsky. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We have an extensive coverage of the news, as well as opinion pieces, in-depth reports from the Middle East, and coverage of national and international issues. Our guest today is Peter Dale Scott, who is based in California, and who has analyzed both the domestic situation as well as the international context. We are discussing President-elect Obama's cabinet and what are the prospects under the new administration. Welcome back, Peter, to the program. You are mildly optimistic,
on different levels. I do think that the scandal of torture will be dealt with. I think Guantanamo is obviously going to be closed, and these are not small things in terms of America's posture in the world. But there are deep forces here. You know, I keep talking about deep politics. That's why I'm less interested in cabinet personnel than I am in the generation of a kind of public opinion which will speak truth to cabinets, whether they're Democratic or Republican. And it's certainly if Americans care about the Constitution, they should be studying the issues that I raise in this article, and particularly a piece of unfinished business, which will help to see whether the difference between the new administration and the old is what's going to happen to continuity of government measures, because these are secret measures which even Congress was not allowed to look at, and will the Democrats, now that they control everything, review these and make some kind of public and transparent determination on which are to be preserved and what's going to be dropped, because many of them, warrantless detention, warrantless surveillance, in my view, have no place in a true democracy.
Yeah, but I mean, in the economic, as far as the economics team is concerned, we still have a certain element of continuity because, as you suggested, Larry Summers, heading the Council of Economic Advisers, who was the architect of the Financial Services Modernization Act in 99, which was in fact a Republican project. Timothy Geithner in the Treasury. I mean, are these people committed to resolving the financial crisis?
I think, you know, that in order to achieve change, you have to have an element of continuity. I am not as upset by seeing the old faces as I am in seeing the absence of some new ones. As I say, it would have been nice to see them balanced by a Stiglitz and a Galbraith. And so it just has to be done through public pressures on them. I think that Obama, I think, wants to be like Roosevelt in his first 100 days with the New Deal, using the crisis as an opportunity. Whether the system will let him do that, I don't know. But, you know, others have come in. Carter planned major changes, never got anywhere. The Clintons were dedicated to health care, never got anywhere. Maybe that continuity is...
We're getting to the end of the program. This is Michel Shostakovich, our guest, Peter Dale Scott. We'll be back next on Friday with Stephen Lenman. Goodbye for now. This is the end of our program. Friday at 10 Central with Stephen Lenman tomorrow, and on Monday through Friday next week.